If you're tired of database limitations and architectures that break when you scale, it's time to think outside rows and columns. MongoDB is the database built for developers by developers. It's ACID compliant, enterprise ready, and fluent with AI. That's why so many of the Fortune 500 trust MongoDB with their most critical workloads. And the best part is developers swear by it, literally. We can't use the actual words they said in this ad, so let's just call it a really great database. Ready to think outside rows and columns? Start building faster at mongodb.com/build.
Support for the show comes from BMC. Before you trust AI to make your business decisions, before you can reliably scale automation across every workflow, before all your data pipelines are connected with intelligence, your business faces some complex challenges ahead. Namely, tackling things like orchestration as a competitive advantage, unifying your modern and legacy systems, or transforming your mainframe. Before you take them on, make sure you do one thing. BMC first. BMC is the automation engine for the AI era. Over the years, they've helped customers worldwide run and modernize their businesses by automating, managing, and optimizing complex IT environments. They've partnered with 80% of the Forbes Global 100. Before automation, before scale, before transformation, before you begin, BMC first. What can you do when you partner with BMC? Get started today. Learn more at bmc.com.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding. Jacob Collier is a rare musician. He's an expert in so many musical languages, Western harmony, negative harmony, microtonalism, and at the same time, he's a phenomenal communicator about these complicated topics. He's kind of the ambassador for music. He goes around the world getting thousands of people, non-musicians and musicians alike, to sing in his audience choirs, conducted with very little direction. I recently had the unique opportunity to sit with Jacob at the piano at On Air Fest in Brooklyn to conduct an audience and song. This conversation caught Jacob between projects. Last year, he'd released The Light for Days, a comparatively minimalist project of beautiful songs written on his five-string guitar. It was quite a turn after his massive Jesse quadrilogy, where he had over 50 collaborators from Herbie Hancock to Anushka Shankar, and literally hundreds of thousands of singers with his audience choirs who were layered into the album. And given that Jacob gets to work and often improvise with the very best collaborators, I decided I wanted a collaborator too for this conversation. Just 5 minutes before the show started, I saw that Sam Sanders was in the audience, co-host of Vibe Check and host of The Sam Sanders Show on KCRW. And so I asked him on stage to join for the interview. Sam is a musician and one of the great music interviewers, and he showed me how improvising in conversation is just as essential as it is in music. The whole thing was caught on tape and is available on YouTube or right here in our feed. Here's my conversation with Jacob Collier and Sam Sanders at On Air about how we are all singers, whether we believe it or not.
I'm really excited for this conversation, Jacob, because, you know, so often as journalists, we often get to chat with musicians when they're just putting a project out. And right now we get to catch you kind of in the middle of life. And I think that's often the best place to catch somebody. Things are processing. Obviously, music is happening in the background. I want to have a conversation today about how you listen, what you hear, and how that inspires you to make music. I think you're one of the few people who is equally as virtuosic in your playing as you are in being able to describe to anybody about how music works. So I want to start off with asking, just like right now, right here, how are you? What are you hearing?
Amazing question. Hi, everybody. How are you? It's nice to see you. I've heard a lot of snow this week, a lot of squeals of delight. Children with like trays and sleds and all manner of joy. And I've been in New York for a month, actually, which has been a while. It's the longest I've been in one place since COVID. And I've been listening intently, sort of within and without. And New York is one of the noisiest, most cacophonous places in the world, and that's a special thing. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to be here at this festival. Musically, you're correct, I'm between. I have completed this quad, these four albums, Jesse, Volume 1, 2, 3, 4. Thank you very much. And And I've toured those sort of very kaleidoscopically around the world for about 8 years without a break. So this is my first break in a while. And it changes the way that I feel and the way that I perceive myself and the way that I perceive the world and music. But the delightful moment I'm in now is not having an agenda and a plan. So that's who you're meeting today, a Jacob without an agenda and a plan. And I've always been a very ravenous listener, you could say. And that's a perpetual thing I feel. And now I'm just on the lookout for new things to grab my attention. Something I heard and loved to listen to that comes to mind, front of mind. Last week I was hanging out with a group of musicians called Sandbox Percussion. Have you come across those?
Anyone here know
Sandbox Percussion? Oh, you're in for a treat. They're so special. They're four extraordinary, classically trained percussionists who do the most mind-blowing, mind-bending, crazy, polyrhythmic, emotional music that I've come across in my long life. And they are very special. So that's a recent sort of ticklage.
So speaking of coming here without an agenda, I invited Sam up about 5 minutes ago. Yeah. Sam, anything occurring to you that you'd like to share with Jacob?
I have a follow-up question on this. Like, what are you hearing right now in your relationship to sound?
Yeah.
I think a lot about how the rise of streaming has changed the way music functions in most people's lives day to day. You know, when my parents were picking a record to put on, there was a conscious choice to listen to this. And they had to listen to know when to flip the record. And you were more attuned, I think, to what you were listening to. And now with Spotify, for better or for worse, I'm not knocking it, you can set these almost ambient playlists. You set it and forget it. And the music becomes a utility that exists in the background. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how the way that we listen now and the way the algorithm can just feed us whatever, how that affects the way people hear music. Because I wonder if it is making the actual relationship weaker. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah, so listening to an album is like a durational activity, right?
That.
Like, okay, I'm in this for a 45-minute train ride,
yes,
or whatever it is.
And the tracks are in that order, and you're going through
it. Yeah, I'm going to be read a story from A to B to C to D to E, etc. That was my childhood as well. Like, I grew up with that psychology. I loved it so much. Still do. I'm holding on. Yeah, it's a different world. It's a changing world. I think there are many valid distances from which to listen to music. I think it's valid to go in intentionally and holding it close and studying it and being in that journey. I also think it's valid to put it on when you're cooking or put it on when you're running or whatever you want to do with your life. And that's a valid distance too. I think I would say that listening to music and making music are more similar than people think. I think that the process of creating music is very similar to the process of listening to music. And if you have the skill set, which many of us don't give ourselves credit for having, to be able to, you could say, like, diagnose your mood and say, I know what I want to listen to right now. I want to listen to Earth, Wind & Fire because I need, you know, I want to listen to Bon Iver because I need, I want to listen to Fleet Foxes because I want to, you know, whatever. That process is very similar in my mind to the process of creating, because I think, well, what do I wish existed right now? What do I want to feel? What do I want to hear? And that feeling of kind of flipping the direction of taste, to me, it's like one of the most important and crucial relationships to build is that with yourself and your taste with yourself. Now, what I notice in the streaming era is a sense of...
Because you lose that, how do I feel, what do I need? It's kind of just, here's what we're giving you.
If you're not careful, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we all have those players. I've started to try and get more intentional about my playlist titles.
Give us some examples.
So, I have all sorts of weird playlists. Like, I have a world-building playlist that's just worlds, like the vividest worlds.
Yeah.
I have a playlist for upwards, energy going upwards. I have a playlist for downwards.
Do you share these publicly? You should.
There's one public one called Jacob's Optimum Music Feast, which you can go and find.
Oh, wonderful.
And it's like 20,000 songs or something ridiculous that I've had since I was, 19 or something. But the upwards and downwards playlists are interesting because I'm a curator as well as a creator. Right? I curate my experience as a listener, and I think at my best as a creator, it's similar to that. I'm also one of these strange artists for whom no genre is off limits. I don't identify as being any particular genre, so I don't think genrically. And it's a fun process to curate this really diverse bunch of music, but put them under the headings of a sensation, a feeling, a direction of travel, a texture of energy. Like I have some places that are just emojis, you know? And it's like, oh, what song feels like it aligns with the emoji that's the pink, the purple devil head or the bubbles or whatever. And that's how I think about this direction and this direction of making music, if that makes sense.
You said that we might put on different things to enhance how we feel, whether we want to feel excited and outward or inward and cold. As a curator or as a musician, do you feel that music's primary role is as some kind of mood medicine?
I think it can be used like that. That's a valid way. It's something I've always turned to music for, is a sense of, you could say like catharsis, a word I love, catharsis. Oof, oh, there it is. Wow, there's the feeling. I think, you know, as a child, when I was growing up, the relationship I was encouraged to have with the world was that it was constantly at play. Everything was constantly at play with me. And I don't necessarily mean musically at play, though sometimes, often. But more that everything had a sense of itself, a personality, a direction, a character. And, you know, growing up, we were kind of all introverts in the family. And I was kind of encouraged to, you could say, study my sort of internal emotional world. And that was like the crucial foundations for the stories that I went on to tell. But I felt like everything had a story, you know, and that was an interesting experience. You know, we'd sit at the dinner table with the pepper grinder, the candlestick, the yogurt pot, you know. And the question would be, oh, are they friends today? You know, are these friends? No, they're not friends. Pepper grinder's going over here. Okay, yogurt pot, all the spoons, you know, whatever. And it sounds kind of trite, but it was so beautiful for me as a kid to have a relationship with the world in that way. Everything was like, whoa, what? I can move, I can break, I can bend, I can play. And as musicians, we play for a living. That's what we do, we play. But to me, playing is a state of being in the world. It's not a job or a task. It's a bi-directional experience. And yeah, I think I've taken that into my adult life too, in a sense.
You talked about building these emotional worlds through music. You know, I think a lot of us as especially maybe lay listeners who might not identify as musicians, but maybe we can upend that later on. Maybe we're more familiar with lyric. Melody comes to us, it gets stuck in our head. I was wondering if we could invite you to the piano. And I'd love to see if you could share with us how harmony creates emotion.
Yeah. My favorite
That's
question.
A big ass.
That's a big ass.
Okay, yeah, I'll try my best.
Okay.
So, I'm going to put this high. So, how many people play the piano here? I'm just curious. Well, that's kind of awesome. Like 56%, solid.
You're a math wizard too, I had no idea.
Yeah. harmony is about tension and release, right? Harmony is about the combination of things with other things. You take a thing and another thing, put them together, that's harmony. Harmony is about relationships. It's a human experience. It's not just a musical experience. So when we study harmony, or I say study, I sort of mean just wiggle around and find stuff, we are controlling tension and release. We're controlling resolution and that the feeling of closing and opening and density, sparsity, that the whole of harmony is built out of things that you already know about intuitively because you're a human with eyes and ears and mouths and noses and brains and bodies. Everybody understands the idea of high and low, right? We know that. We know about that, high and low. We know about bright and dark. We know about thick and thin. We know about rough and smooth. We know about many and few. We know these things. We recognize them in ourselves and others. So if I play a chord like this, you have a sense of, you know? It's like a coral reef or it's like a bumblebee cloud or something, you know? Many, high, dense. These are the principles at play. If I play a chord like that, or maybe even that, suddenly we're in a whole different world. We're in like a cavernous place that's more, it's lower, it's darker, it's lower down. The distances between the notes are bigger. It's more like this. That's how I've experienced that chord. And every sound world has its own kind of sonority. And the journey of being an arranger, a harmonist, a piano player, a singer, whatever, is, yeah, to sort of create relationships with things. And so one of my favorite things to do with this, and maybe a helpful way to answer the question, is to take a song that you know and to give it different forms of harmonic context to maybe help you understand like what's possible harmonically. Because the melody's not going to change, but the harmony can change. What's a song that I could work with that, or anyone, what's a song that I could work with here that... Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Banger. In what key?
F.
I was hoping you'd say F. What happened at the end there? Something happened at the end there. The truth is, F, can you sing an F? Ooh, can you sing that? Yeah. So that F is perfectly comfortable. Keep singing. In this chord. Keep singing. As this chord, right? That'll do for now. Isn't that an amazing feeling, being an F and seeing your contexts move and change? I'm obsessed with this. As a child, as a 12-year-old, you would catch me at home with the note F, for example, finding every single possible chord that works with F. Those are unlimited chords, right? So when we play the song Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, we're trying to create these relationships and what I'm playing with really is your expectation, because that's what's already there, your sense of what feels inevitable, what feels natural, what feels kind of, yeah, what feels, what does it feel like? Suddenly everything's really quiet. So, for example, if I keep the bass note, ooh, this F, if I keep that solid, and that doesn't change, but the chords do change otherwise. There's tension there. You're feeling this tension, right? Oh, right? It's released. So that's one way of making tension. Pedal notes, right? Notes that go all the way through. And then there are so many other things you can do. I can only use chords with loads of notes close together in them. And it's like, right? Or I can only use notes that are really far apart.
Labbucks on free bet spins or even cash in for real money. That's Ladisfaction from Labbrooks. And for extra Ladisfaction, here's the T's and C's. Let's rock!
18 plus. Participate in selected promotions to get Labbucks.
Oh, get Labbucks.
Redeem them for offers or rewards. Labbucks expire for T's and C's apply. Take time to think. Gamble well.org.
Now, all the traitors present, let's get started, shall we?
From rags to riches.
I'm so sick of this.
Working like a dog and being treated worse.
Yorkshire to New York.
We're climbers, you and me.
A life dedicated to revenge.
Let's make this an occasion to remember.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4 starts tonight at 9.
When you think about wealth inequality in America, there's probably one man whose name comes to mind. And yes, he did compare America's billionaire era to the Gilded Age.
We're living in a moment where the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 93%, where one man, Elon Musk, owns more wealth than the bottom 53% of American households, where, while 60% of our people are living paycheck to paycheck, the billionaire class has seen its wealth increase by $1.5 trillion since Trump was elected. How's that? They doing pretty well?
I talked to Senator Bernie Sanders about his latest bill for a wealth tax and his call for a moratorium on AI data centers. Plus, how much he uses AI himself. Today Explained, every weekday, and now on Saturdays too.
You did this thing when you got up here where you immediately had the whole room just join you in singing F. And I followed your career for a long time. You always love to have a crowd sing with you. Have you ever gotten a room that can't sing with you? And how do you work that?
Is that a challenge?
No. I mean, just because it's like, it's become a part of your live shows.
Yes.
Singing with your audience, directing them like a choir.
When you're going
to do that, do you just assume that every room and every audience can be able to sing with you? Or is there a certain calculus?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And we could easily spend the rest of the time talking about this one thing. I know that everybody can sing. Because everybody can speak.
Have you met my brother?
Yeah. I have not. I know that everybody can sing. The question is, to what degree of resolution can they sing in tune? Can they listen to each other? Can they move around harmonically? I've toured now for 10 years, and it's everything from beautiful, pristine performing arts centers, arenas, concert halls, to like the grungiest of grungy festival stages, 4 p.m. outdoors, drunk, 11 p.m., super high, or conference rooms with no one's paying attention. Here's what I'd say. Everyone can do, hey-o! Everyone can do that. And the first thing that I do when I go on stage is usually that, and I diagnose from that, okay.
Wait, so what you're like, I'm hearing if they're good or not. So I'm hearing if they got
so
it.
I get a sense with you that you can actually hold a three-part chord just about fine, that you're going to be able to move up and down pretty good. You might not go full chromatic, which is my like the wrist thing, which we can try later. But if I go, ooh, 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 sounds just lovely. And then if you, all of you over there go, ah, ooh, ah. Yeah, it's pretty good.
I also feel like what you do when you do that, you are kind of showcasing how I think everyone wants to sing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't sing enough.
Yeah.
But as soon as someone says sing, you're like, I would love to do that.
So here's the thing. Permission is more important than skill. That's the thing. And it's crazy. It's so overrated, the idea that someone is qualified, someone is, you know, whatever. Someone is qualified, someone is not. The thing with singing is so inherent to us that if you're just given the opportunity to participate and you're invited, you step forward and you're in. And my job is to make you feel comfortable and make you feel confident and not to put you in a position where you feel unsafe and to challenge you. And this is a model of leadership that I believe in very strongly, and I've operated in for many, many years now. And the same thing, I'm going to move it back to my chair.
No, stay at that piano. We like you there.
The same thing goes in the studio. You know, there are producers in this world, music producers, who I won't name names, but who kind of feel the best possible route to galvanizing a good emotional result out of a collaborator is to just intimidate them. You know, they say, "Oh, I know way more than you do. You don't know the first thing about blah blah. Do you know what I've done?" You know, And even in smaller, more subtle ways, just belittling, just, you know, elbowing around. It's so not how I was brought up. It's so not what I believe in. It so doesn't work on me, you know? And so I'm only as powerful as I make you feel, as your producer, as your conductor, as your performer. And so that to me feels like the ultimate thing to focus on as a creative person. And the audience choir would not work if I told people to do things. I show them what's possible, and then I push them, and they show them what's possible, and they leave the room thinking, God, I did that. We did that. And if people focus their energy on one thing and love one thing as a room, they tend to love each other as well. And amazing things happen after audience choirs. Like people, there's all these bonds that have been made just through trust, you know, just through the simplicity of that.
Jacob, in addition to working as a music journalist, I also moonlight as a music educator. And one of the things I just run into so frequently with my students, I like you close too. It's nice to be closer to. Rub heads. It always happens when we present songs to each other for feedback is, well, every excuse of why this thing is not good. And I hear it from my music students. I feel like I hear it even more from people who are so quick to not identify as a musician. You know, maybe they like played piano when they were a kid and they gave it up. Oh, I'm not a musician. What do you say to that voice?
Well, I mean, first of all, that is unfortunately a very common psychology. A lot of people, I mean, everyone's a musician because we have bodies and voices and we're rhythmic and constantly at play. But a lot of people have music kind of stained by education at a young age and the wrong kind of education. Teachers like this, like the thing I was saying before, wrapping you over the knuckles and this is the one way to do it. So the first thing is, like, you're not alone, you know, and I think someone said once, you know, the creative adult is the child who survived. And I've always kind of thought that's very true because there are so many forces as you grow that try and close you down, shut you down, strip you of your confidence, of your individuality, of your sparkle, of all the stuff. And music is one of those, it's one of those languages that is revealing of a person. And I think if you're made to feel unsafe or you're made to feel small or you're made to feel irrelevant or whatever, which is not to say that you're not pushed and challenged, by the way, but if that's the emotional constitution to the teacher or whatever, it's hard. Like there are like unhealable wounds often that happen there. But you know, the thing I think with art, and there are even artists who didn't quite have that experience but have just gone into the music industry and got burnt out by pressure, adrenaline, expectation, the need to make money, whatever it is. And I think that these, what I say to people in any of those situations is just to find and hold on to what you kind of first loved. What was it that you first was drawn to and first loved? Because I think that, I know for me, the music I loved when I was 2, 5, 11, 16, 19, that still is my whole, it's still Stevie Wonder, it's still Bob McFerrin, it's still Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
You know, it's still Johann Sebastian Bach. Because they were my first heroes. And so when I get deflated and worn down and what do I do? How do I combine this? What do I do? What's worth building? Does this even make a difference? A lot of the time it's just finding, it's the thing we were saying before about diagnosing what it is that I feel like I wish existed, what I wish I could listen to. And sometimes it's going back to those early things that rekindles that spark.
Can I follow up on that? Just in terms of like hearing you work with this room right now, I feel like you are and would be in a classroom a very empathetic music educator, but I think about a lot of the folks that taught me when I was growing up, and it's like I have this archetype or trope of like the mean piano teacher who'd like wrap you over the hand, or like whatever teacher taught the kids poetry and made poetry not fun. They made you memorize it and recite it, and like, you know, these art forms were turned into ways in which an adult could be strict to a child. What would you change, the biggest change you'd make in the way that we teach our children music if you were in charge of it all?
You know, the tricky thing with education is everyone needs a little bit of something different. It's so hard to find a one-size-fits-all. Everyone needs to be tickled in a certain way to get the best out of them. And so it's like, what's the form of mass ticklage that genuinely works for, is there even such a thing? And I don't know if there is. I think we need empathetic human beings to be in these positions. there are many reasons why. I mean, growing up in England and seeing the state of the England arts funding situation right now, it's a little dire. You know, it's a teacher has every reason to lose faith in their ability to feel confident and safe and expansive and creative in a classroom. I think it's a much more systematic problem than hey, here's just a better rule book for you. Mm-hmm. Just teach these rules instead, because it's not going to work for someone. You know, like what worked for me as a kid simply doesn't work for another kid.
What worked for you as a kid?
A lot of space to wiggle around, clear limitations and boundaries, and then like forgiveness of me going over every line possible, which I always did. I would break everything I was given. I'd eat everything I was given musically. You know, but that's because I have a particular type of brain. Like that's I have a particular type of brain, and some people would much rather be told exactly what to do and to be. It's about consistency and it's about being, much more systematic. I'm maybe a strange case, but in general, we need empathetic human beings. As someone said this about being a musician anyway, you know, the world doesn't need more good musicians. The world needs more good people. But being a musician is a great way of being a good person, because when we study music, we're actually studying all the best parts of being a human. We're studying empathy and trust and risk and physics and mathematics and balance and form and language and leadership and syntax and grammar, like literally the whole thing, history, geography, you know, is all in there. I would hope that a music teacher is an ambassador for life and is a verb and not a noun. My favorite teachers are verbs. They show it, they don't tell it. They don't sit there saying, this is the thing in theory, it's this. It's this. It's like, we're going to start today by, I'm going to play you something I absolutely love. And I want to hear what you think about it. And then you listen and you play and you experience that. And because the best thing a teacher can do is give you the conditions to build your own relationships with music. It's not superimposing the teacher's relationships to music, but that does come down to being a human being with an open mind and communication skills and a sense of not knowing everything. That's the one thing I do feel is I don't know. I'm not qualified to tell you exactly what everything is, but I can show you what I absolutely love and why I absolutely love it. And that's a good place to start, maybe. Yeah.
When I first started playing music, I really loved improvisation. That was the thing that first got me. And it took me many, many years to get into the world of melody. So I was wondering if we might be able to put you back into the role of educator for a second. And to share a little bit about what is the minimum amount of information that is necessary to make a melody? And then what do you do to expand on it to make it into song?
I'll give you three things. The first thing is I'll tell you a lesson I was taught about melody because I asked a teacher of mine. His name's Mike Walker. He's a beautiful guitar player from England. I said, "Hey, Mike, how do I make a good melody?" And he said, "Well, play me a melody." That's what he said. So I played him something. Or something like that. And he was like, "Okay, fine." Then he said, "Sing me a melody." So I went, "Oh." He said, "Okay." Now he said, "Now I want you to listen in your imagination and imagine a girl comes up to you, sings you a melody, and I want you to sing back what she sings to you." So I sort of closed my eyes, went to my imagination. So girl appeared, lovely, great. And then I sort of waited for this character to sing this melody. And there was so much like rhyme and balance and order and poetry and symmetry in the melody that came out. And he said, "Oh, that's the end of the lesson. Like, that's everything you need to know for a melody." And it really stayed with me. This was 15 years ago. But there's this sense that a good melody was already there. You just need to unlock it. And that you also have to kind of get rid of the crud and the crap in the front of your brain and sometimes work through the sort of cobwebs of front of mind stuff and get to what's really going on. He was the kind of teacher who'd say, you know, play a chord that's your mother, you know, or
which chord is that?
No, that's a personal question.
Sorry.
you know, like I remember talking to Herbie Hancock about his piano teachers, and he started with this guy called Chris Anderson, who was blind and had this kind of bone disease where he was constantly like this. And he was one of the most amazing piano players of all time. And Herbie speaks about, you know, he'd play a standard for Chris and Chris would just be like, add salt, you know, or kind of like, less purple, you know, stuff like that. And I really, that's totally my thing. As you can probably tell, that's totally my thing. So anyway, yeah, just the sense that, behind, underneath the mind is the heart. And actually, underneath the heart is the gut, and they all power each other in this direction. And Mike's exercise went from here to here to here, and the melodies just got better. So that's one thing I wanted to share. Another exercise I was taught as a child, which was actually an improvisation exercise, as you mentioned, improvisation, was that of a fun way of improvising a melody is to do one note, and then to add one note to the note, and then add one note to those two notes, and one note to those three notes. A bit like that game where it's like, I went to the market and I bought a fish.
Can you show us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to think of, say with Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, the chords for Twinkle Twinkle Star is this, kind of. So actually, let's just do this. Let's do this. If I go, na, 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 and I start again. Exercise is, I know, I had something to say, but do you get the sense of how, like, you can follow what's going on a little bit? It's like, and at a certain point, you're following threads, and that, I think the best melodies do that. They're not constantly reinventing themselves. I mean, you can have a cool melody that does that, but that was a really helpful exercise for me in melodic development, you could say. You can also like pick a certain number of notes and only work with that number, so three notes. Like if we do a bit of a call and response thing, because I know you want to sing. if I... forget it. If I go... No! Well done, everybody. That was great.
Wow.
As a rule, all my phrases are short. I went into that saying, "Oh, every phrase will be three notes," and I accidentally did like five and six. But I like the idea of limiting it to a time frame. You have two beats. I have two beats, and it has to be singable. These are all good principles for melodies.
We're having this wonderful conversation that feels so alive, and walking into your world in your mind is just phenomenal. But I know that as soon as everyone leaves this environment, they'll be in any number of musical spaces that are increasingly being touched by AI. that will make the melody and make the song and sing it for you and make the artist. There was a Christian artist who topped the Christian Billboard charts for a few months ago, all AI.
No.
Dude has a bio, photos, he's cute, it's weird. I'm wondering, for you, what part of the rise of AI, if any, gives you the most pause, particularly when talking about humans making melody and music together?
Yeah. Whoa. You know me enough to know how much I love human beings, right? So the first thing to say is that we've never needed humanity more than we need it right now. And so where does that leave us in this crazy moment of generative models, large language models, predictive models? Here's what I think is interesting about a prediction model. You have a model that has been trained to satisfy your expectations. And there's this thing in the back end of AIs called the top K. I don't know how much you know about like the tech of AI. So the top K is everything likely to happen in the order from most likely to least likely, right? So the top 50 in the list of top K is like, if I say I, then the large language model will say, you know, went, feel, think, whatever, all the most likely things for me to say. If I go down that list of top K into the least likely stuff, I get really weird words. You know, I truncate is probably not in the top 1,000, but I do. My whole process of learning music was about understanding my relationship with expectation and like how to break it and how to twist it, how to work with it. So is AI interesting? Yeah, it's very interesting. I think it's our duty as artists to explore it so that we know what parts of it to truly condemn, actually. If we condemn the whole thing off the bat, AI bad, then I feel like that's like a low resolution response.
Which part do you condemn right now, if any?
There are a few. One is the way these models are trained, and the fact that they're trained on
theft.
On us, it's theft. They're trained on us musicians, without our permission. We're not paid. They are filled with our hard-earned experience, taste, contributions, and then they can squeeze out these little weird impressions of those things, which is absolutely bizarre and very strange. The thing I think I condemn almost even more is just the freaking predicts. It's so generic. I hate generic. I can't stand it. I would never trust a human who had a top K of 10 or something. Like, I would never trust an obedient, creative person. So I'm not going to trust the computer for doing the thing I think it thinks I want to hear. My duty as a creator is to try and break it, as I've broken everything else I've been interested in. Chords, harmony, rhythm, people, whatever. I haven't really broken any people, not recently, anyway. But I love the idea of investigating what it's good at and what it's bad at, and it's bad at a lot of stuff, and it misses the point in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think our freedom, increasingly, in a world of algorithms and AI, is actually our unpredictability. I think that's a little bit of a superpower that we have, and it's because we're biologically limited, and we're limited by our need for love, and our weird, wiggly faces, and our low-resolution language, and our slowness, and our inefficiency. It's beautiful. I love it so much. And there's this myth of efficiency, like the faster the thing is achieved, the better. But in music, we know that silence is not inefficient. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like...
Neither is slowness.
No. Who gets the end of the piece fastest wins, you know. Yeah, those aren't the competitions here. And I have conversations with, you know, a lot of tech-minded people. And when I say that to them, they have this moment of recognizing, oh... Right, because in the world of tech, like, silence is inefficient. You know, if I'm going to take a moment now before I play my next phrase, it's like, we're waiting. We're on the clock, you know. But in music, it's like, you know, you don't dance to get to the end of to the other side of the room. That's not why we dance. We dance to go around in a circle. And so when we think about human art and the value of art and beauty in the world, it doesn't come from efficiency. It doesn't come from competence. To me, there's something joyous about recognizing how much of a wrecking ball things are created through sheer competence and nothing else. It's never made me cry, competence. I love that. She was so competent, I just wept, you know. I've never said, but that's AI. It's so competent. And so, we need to hold on to all the inefficiencies. And I also think it's important to explore what's there and understand it for yourself. And I think I've learned a lot about myself and my taste through poking it and trying to get it to be interesting. Artists are question askers. They're master question askers. AI only works. It's only as good as the question you ask it. And so if you ask it a generic question, you get a generic answer. And one thing I would say I've enjoyed about it is that it demands I ask non-generic questions. And the muscle of asking non-generic questions I can take into anything I do on a stage, in a room of collaborators with 10,000 audience members, with a musical instrument. So it's helpful for getting to know myself and my taste, but God, it's a really hairy moment we're in. I would say that. Yeah.
What you're speaking to is something I struggle with. Sometimes maybe you can help me unlock some creative block that I've got that I think maybe some other people in the room might have as well. You know, as a journalist, I come and I over-prepare. I listen to everything, take all my notes. Sometimes I have to invite some chaos into the whole process just to let myself loose. Because conversation has to be improvisatory, just like music, in the same way that it also has to be prepared.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you joining and bringing some of that energy,
honored,
Sam.
To do it.
But so I sometimes find as someone who is required to do a lot of preparation, I'm often required in my job to be highly analytical. I often think about music highly analytically. Then I have to go be a creative person. What are some ways that I can turn that analytical brain off and go back to the child mind that you spoke about earlier?
Yeah, great question, man. I want to know the answer to that too sometimes, for sure. You know, Quincy Jones used to tell me, follow your goosebumps. That was his big thing. Follow your goosebumps. They'll never lead you wrong. Follow your goosebumps. Goosebumps are non-cerebral. They don't show up when you think about something really hard. You know, it doesn't happen. Goosebumps happen when they want to happen. They're like the Northern Lights or something. Whoa, oh my God. So when they show up, it's like a sign that it's this brain talking rather than this one. To go back to the triage of brains thing, goosebumps come from like the bottom of your feet. Whoa, I'm grounded, I'm in. So sometimes you have to recognize the response your body's already having to something emotionally, because feeling moves faster than thought, right? You feel quicker than you think, even if I imagine you're probably quite a quick thinker, as I am. So sometimes it's like, but it's still quicker. It still gets to you quicker. So
it's the flam of emotion before thought.
Yeah. There's something to that. You know when I really hit a block and a rut and I'm thinking too much. PEMDAS. Does that mean anything to you?
Math?
Yeah. So in the UK we have BIDMAS because we say brackets, you say parentheses. That's some weird thing.
Parentheses, exponents, multiply, divide, add, subtract.
That's the thing.
Okay.
Wow. My man over here knows his PEDMAS, whatever it is. I think there's like a PEDMAS to emotions. I mean, this is a whole different talk. But I think there is when I get into a rut, when I hit a block, the first thing to think about is, did I sleep? Did I eat? Did I have a rest? And I don't judge anything until I've done those things. I'm a fool to say, maybe I have a huge problem with my personality. Maybe I need to date someone else. Maybe I need to, I might, you know, it's like, okay, did I sleep? Nope. Okay, I should go to sleep. My sister has a thing where she's like, I don't judge myself for anything until I've had 3 consecutive nights of 8 hours of sleep, which I'm like, when will I ever have that?
Yeah, never happened.
But when you get into a rut, please just ask yourself, did I eat and did I sleep and have I rested? The second layer of that is like, have I been challenged? Have I been creative? Have I been watered? Like, has my flower been watered? It's also like a bit like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing, the pyramid of needs thing. It's just like, there are reasons why you might be blocked, you know. And sometimes, you know, you have slept, you have eaten, you have had company, you have gone outside, you have done exercise, all these things. And actually what you need is to cry. Or you might need to break a rule. Or you might need to listen to music. Or you might need to stop trying so hard. Or you might need to stand up straight. You know, I have a whole list. I have like a list of 100 things. And I love it. And it's helpful for me because it's often not the thing you think it is that's blocking you. If you're blocked, it just means there's energy that's stuck. It just can't quite come through. And the mind is like the ultimate ninja blocker of feeling, no, 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 I won't let you. It just goes against the thing I think about me, you know. One creative way of getting through a block is to try and make the worst thing you've ever made, deliberately. Go in being like, what's the worst song in the world? I'll make that one. And whenever I do this, I always make it something interesting. And whenever I sit down and try and make something that everybody's going to love and it's going to hit the top of the charts and I'm going to, it's going to, you know, whatever. Everyone on this podcast audience is going to love me or whatever. I tend to make things that are less interesting. So there's a liberation to recognizing that, hey, what if it's fine to make the worst thing in the world? What if you try to make the worst thing in the world? And suddenly your brain's like, well, I can't help you with that. And then your unconscious things come through and it gets more interesting.
I know we have to go, but can I ask a selfish question?
Yes.
Based on this conversation and the vibe in this room and of this chat, recommend a song or an album for us to listen to as we leave here, to play as we leave the room or on our days.
A song or an album?
Yeah. That speaks to this moment that we've had together. Anything.
Oh, there's so many.
First one that comes to mind.
First one that comes to mind is Adrian Lenker's Songs album. Do you know that?
Say it again so they can hear it.
Adrian Lenker.
Spell Lenker.
L-E-N-K-E-R.
Okay.
Yeah, Songs. What a record. Check out, listen to Not A Lot, Just Forever. Listen to that song. I feel like we've been speaking a bit about kind of like softness actually and gentleness and awareness and texture. It's a beautifully aware, soft, gentle, textural album. So maybe check that out. And then Sandbox Percussion, who I mentioned earlier on. They have a record called Pillars. That's very, very different from the Adrian Lenker record, but you should definitely also check that record out because it's incredible.
We have to leave. We have some listening homework, but we can't just be listeners. We also must be musicians as well. Would you mind leaving us with just a moment of collective singing?
Yes.
Very briefly.
I'd love to.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'd love to.
I appreciate it, Jacob.
I see trees green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, go! Skies blue, clouds are white, bright, blessed day, dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, whoa, go. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, and also the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you do. They really say it. I hear babies crying, I watch them grow, they'll know much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful this I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Switched on Pop is produced by Rana Cruz, edited by Lissa Soap, engineered by Brandon McFarlane, illustrations by Iris Gottlieb, video by Nick Rips, music by Zach Tenario and Jossie Adams of Arc Iris. We're a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network and a production of Vulture, which is part of New York Mag. You can subscribe at nymag.com/pod. Again, if you want to see this whole conversation live on video, you can go see it over on YouTube. We'll be back again next week. And until then, thanks for listening.